Well, thank you, and good afternoon. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. The Commonwealth Club is holding this event in cooperation with the Sasakawa Peace Foundation USA and the Japan Society of Northern California. And I'm Dan Bob, Director of Programs and Senior Fellow at Sasakawa USA, and I'm also your moderator for today's program. Sasakawa USA, by the way, is an American think tank based in Washington, D.C., and we're a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that focuses on U.S.-Japan relations in the broadest sense, not only bilaterally, but also regionally and globally. Today's program, we're going to be looking at image and reality in U.S.-Japan relations, how Americans view Japanese, how Japanese view Americans, and how both assess the ties between our two countries. Now, 2015 marks the 70th anniversary since the end of World War II, and so Sasakawa USA decided to commission two projects on the state of U.S.-Japan relations. The first was with Pew Research, and Pew did polling both in the U.S. and in Japan on opinions each side held toward the other. The second project was with the East-West Center, and they expanded and updated some work that they'd already initiated on the extent of Japan's involvement and presence in U.S. states and congressional districts. And they did this across a wide variety of measures. Now, we've assembled a really expert panel to discuss the findings of these two projects, as well as take a look at the overall depth and strength of U.S. ties with Japan. Our distinguished panelists include, from my right onward, the Honorable John Roos, former U.S. Ambassador to Japan from 2009 to 2013. During his tenure, Ambassador Roos played a particularly active role during one of the most significant periods in U.S.-Japan relations. When the March 11th earthquake struck in 2011, followed by the tsunami and the partial meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear power plant, he facilitated what was really the most important joint operation of American and Japanese troops in the post-war period. The two sides cooperated in assisting those most affected by the disaster and in the cleanup operation. In 311's aftermath, he launched the Tomodachi Initiative, which is a major effort at bringing Americans and Japanese together at a grassroots level. He was also the first sitting U.S. ambassador to attend the commemoration ceremonies of the atomic bombings in Hiroshima and in Nagasaki. And as ambassador, he put a particular emphasis on innovation, entrepreneurship, and trade, and including helping to work to gain Japan's accession to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Before his appointment as ambassador, John served as chief executive officer and senior partner at the law firm of Wilson, Sonsoni, Goodrich, and Rosati, which is based in Palo Alto. He also did his studies in the area, getting his degrees both from Stanford University and Stanford Law School. Second panelist is Satou Lemay, director of East-West Center offices in Washington, D.C. Dr. Lemay developed and directs the Asia Matters for America initiative, which is an interactive resource for nonpartisan information on U.S.-Asia relations. Previously, Satou worked at the Institute for Defense Analyses, as well as the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies in Hawaii. And he's a graduate of Georgetown University and received his doctorate from Oxford, where he was a George C. Marshall Scholar. Our final panelist is Bruce Strokes, who is Director of Global Economic Attitudes at Pew Research Center's Global Attitudes Project. And there he assesses public and expert views on economic conditions, values, and policies. Before joining Pew, Bruce worked as the international economics correspondent at the National Journal. He was also a senior transatlantic fellow at the German Marshall Fund and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Bruce is also a graduate of Georgetown University, as well as the Johns Hopkins University's School for Advanced International Studies. Please join me in welcoming all of our panelists. We're going to begin today's presentations with Bruce and Satu, who will talk about the Pew and East-West Center projects they headed up. Then we'll turn to Ambassador Roos for his thoughts, and then open up to discussion. So, Bruce, you're first up.
Thank you, Dan, and it's a real pleasure and a privilege to be here. The Pew Research Center would like to thank Sasakawa for your support for this survey, which we think gives us great insight into the nature of the U.S.-Japan relationship 70 years after the war. And we'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club because this is a great opportunity to share some of this very interesting data with you. For those of you who are not familiar with, and I think unfortunately the computer has frozen, so let me see if I can unfreeze it. There we go. For those of you who are not familiar with the Pew Research Center, we are a non-advocacy, non-partisan group in Washington funded by the Pew Charitable Trust, and our again, I'm having trouble moving. Are the slides moving? Because they're not moving on my screen. No. Okay. Let's see if we can fix that. Here. Maybe I could do that. What do you think? Nope. Oh, now it's moving. Yeah, now it's moving. It wasn't before. No, that's what I did. Anyway, all of the material I'm about to present to you is available at www.pewresearch.org. We do surveys in 40 countries on a range of topics, from religion to politics to social mores. The most important thing about this database is that it's searchable. So if you ever want to know if the Kenyans, how the Kenyans feel about gay marriage, we've asked them. You know. And a range of other questions that have been asked. This survey was done in February and by telephone, 1,000 respondents in the United States and 1,000 in Japan. And the makeup of the survey, it covers the entire country, and if 30% of the population of the country has a college degree, then 30% survey respondents will have a college degree. If 51% are female, then 51% of the respondents will be female. In other words, the survey reflects the demography of both Japan and the United States. And the margin of error is about 3.2 to 3.6%. The main takeaway is that we trust each other 70 years after the war and very strongly trust each other. Two-thirds of Americans trust the Japanese to be a good ally, and 75% of the Japanese trust us. Neither one of us trust China. We trust China a little bit more than the Japanese do, but I wouldn't say that either one of us trust China very much. And we disagree about whether Japan should play a more active military role in regional affairs. By 2-1, Americans would like to see Japan play more of a military role in the region. As Dan mentioned, one of the reasons they commissioned this survey and why we were interested in it was it is the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. Prime Minister Abe was coming to Washington. We knew that the history of the relationship would be an important part of that visit. So we wanted to get a sense of, in both the Japanese public's mind and in the American public's mind, how do we view this relationship? What historical events stick out when people think about the relationship? What we found was that 31% of Americans still say it's World War II. That is the single most important thing that's happened in the relationship. 31% say it was the tsunami, and not a whole lot in between. For someone of my generation, who grew up in the trade war period. I would have expected people to say the trade wars. I would have said the trade wars if they'd asked me that question. But only 8% of Americans believe that the trade wars of the 1980s and early 1990s are the single most important thing in the relationship in the last 70 years. It's interesting for the Japanese, it is the military alliance that has been the single most important thing in the relationship. Notably, when Americans say, when 31% of Americans say it's World War II, it's 40% of people 65 and older, which I think is not surprising, because they obviously are much closer to that event. We ask people in Japan and the United States, do you think Japan has apologized sufficiently for its military activities in the 1930s and 1940s? Or do you think Japan has not apologized enough? Or is no apology necessary? And we've asked this all over Asia as well. 61% of Americans say that Japan has apologized enough, or that there's nothing to apologize for. Now, we think in those people who say in the United States there's nothing to apologize for, probably a lot of this is it's 70 years ago, we're past this. In Japan, people are equally willing to say we've apologized enough. And in fact, you get an even larger percentage who say we've apologized enough or there's nothing to apologize for. I do think that probably in Japan, some of those people who say there's nothing to apologize for really mean that, that we didn't do anything wrong. So there is a slight different interpretation. It's 15% in Japan who say there's nothing to apologize for. It's 24% in America who say there's nothing to apologize for. I will tell you, in Korea, 98% of people say the Japanese have not apologized sufficiently. And in China, it's 78%. So there is a problem with some of Japan's Eastern Asian neighbors on this issue. Question that hangs over the relationship for those of you who travel to Japan: what about Hiroshima and Nagasaki? The ambassador was the first ambassador to go to Hiroshima, as was mentioned. In 1945, when the American public was asked, was this bombing justified, right after the bombing, 85% of Americans said yes, it was justified. In the early 90s, it was 63%. Now it's only 56% of Americans who say that the bombing was justified. Clearly, Americans are rethinking the justification for the bombing. I can tell you that less than half of Americans, 18 to 29, think the bombing was justified. So I think it's probably safe to predict at some point less than half of Americans will say it is justified. The Japanese overwhelmingly say it was unjustified. 79% say it was unjustified, and that number has actually gone up over the years. How do we feel about each other today? There's widespread trust in America of Japan across all demographic groups. Men slightly more than women, but still a majority of women trust Japan. There is no partisan difference in the United States on this issue. Democrats, Republicans, independents equally trust Japan. Similarly, there's widespread and equal trust of the United States by the Japanese, although, again, men tend to be slightly more trusting of the United States than are women. But again, 68% of Japanese women trust the United States, so it's not that significant. What about the economic relationship? As we mentioned, the trade wars do not play a big role in people's memory of the relationship today. We have been asking the public, the American public, is Japan a fair trader or not a fair trader? Notice in 1989, by almost 3-1, Americans said Japan was an unfair trader. Today, by 2-1, we say Japan is a fair trader. This statistic has changed dramatically over the years. Bear in mind that the nominal U.S. trade deficit with Japan hasn't changed that much. The inflation-adjusted trade deficit with Japan has gone down, And the percentage of our trade deficit, our total trade deficit that's from Japan, has gone down dramatically because of China. And when we ask people in the United States, who are the unfair traders, the Americans say, no, Japan's a fair trader. 48% of Americans say that China is an unfair trader. So we can only have one boogeyman at a time, and now it's China. That brings us to the elephant in the room, China and Japan, and how that figures in our relationship with Japan. When we ask Americans, does the rise of China as a military and economic power make relations between the U.S. and Japan more important or less important? Americans overwhelmingly, 60% to 6%, say it makes the relationship with Japan more important. Nevertheless, when you force Americans to choose, do you want stronger economic relations with China or Japan, Americans say China. So it suggests, even though we want to be closer to Japan, if we have to choose for economic reasons, we choose China. And I think this is something the Japanese have to take to heart, that Americans are nothing if they're not pragmatic about these things. We do support more than the Japanese, seeing the Japan play a bigger military role in the region, but we shouldn't overinterpret that. Only 47% of Americans want Japan to play a bigger role, a military role in the region. 43% want to see a limited role for Japan in the region. Frankly, I expected that number in the United States to be higher. Given the war weariness of Americans, given the burden-sharing debate on defense that's gone on for many, many years, I would have expected Americans to be more willing to see Japan play a bigger military role. But it's still just around half of Americans want that to happen. Finally, we ask Americans and Japanese about their stereotypes of the other. Now, bear in mind, stereotypes can be abused, they can be ugly, they can seem trivial. But on the other hand, we all carry stereotypes around in our head. Stereotypes help affect our feelings about issues that we haven't thought about very much, but they inform that how we view things. So we ask Americans about the attributes of Japanese, and we ask Japanese about the attributes of Americans. As you can see, Americans believe that Japanese are hardworking, inventive, and honest. Japanese aren't so sure Americans are hardworking. They think we're aggressive and we're selfish. These are stereotypes. These are things when you're trying to deal, as the ambassador did, with the relationship, you have to kind of deal with these stereotypes and figure out how to respond to them. Finally, we ask people in America, what is the first word that comes to your mind when we mention Japan? And surprisingly or not surprisingly, it was sushi. Then it was cars, and it was World War II. And I think it's interesting that the third most mentioned word was World War II. We still do not have a deep understanding of this relationship. It's in part, I think, a reflection of the fact that our culture still has movies about World War II, and there's a lot of talk about World War II, but not a whole lot about the rest of the relationship in the last 70 years. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruce. Satu?
Well, good morning and good afternoon, I guess, at this point. Mentioned, my name is Satu LeMay, and I'm from the East-West Center. The headquarters of the East-West Center are in Honolulu, Hawaii. For my sins, I was sent to Washington, and I've been there for several years working our programs there. The East-West Center, just so you know, by way of background, was established by the U.S. Congress in 1960 to promote education, research, and exchange between the United States and Asian countries. And so we have about 15, 16,000 alumni who've participated in various degree, education, training, exchange programs, and we do a number of other things. By way of starting, let me just say I'm delighted to be here and thank Sasagawa Peace Foundation for their support on this Japan Matters for America project, and also an organization called the U.S.-Japan Friendship Commission, which also assisted us in doing the website. And I can't help but proceed without mentioning that Ambassador Roos was one of the first folks to use social media to make people aware of our effort as he flew from Japan to Denver for the first flight between Denver and Japan when we launched this project in Colorado. Let me move to the website. What I'd like to do is quickly show you the website. Bruce mentioned, let's see if I can get on this website here. I am not, it's funny to say this in San Francisco area, but I'm not an IT guru. Here's the website. I hope you can see it. I'm going to just quickly go through a few elements of it. Can you see it? Oh, it's not projected on. Oh, because I can't see the screen. Let me see. Do you know how we can?
Not yet. No.
Blank.
Huh.
Do we need to close out of the PowerPoint?
Yeah, maybe. It's not connected.
Visible now?
No.
No. Not yet.
Do we have a tech person in the room by chance? In-house staff.
Well, I don't want to hold up the program. Maybe let me give you the website's address, and maybe we won't be able to show all of the elements of the website. But basically, it's very simple to remember, AsiaMattersForAmerica.org. And the website will allow you to go in and read news, data, information, visuals, analysis about U.S.-Asia relations nationally and by every U.S. state and congressional district. And the Japan element, there are tabs for Asia as a whole, for the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, which is the 10 countries of Southeast Asia, Japan, Korea, Australia, and we're in the process of building for China, India, and Taiwan. So that's the website, and what you can do is please spend a few minutes playing around on it. Basically, it gives you interactive data. You can click on the congressional district for California, 13th district, and find out how Japan impacts, for example, this congressional district or any in California or by state, and you can print out the PDFs. The other element of the project are booklets, which have the information visuals. We didn't print a lot off because they take a lot of paper, but they are also available on PDF on the site, and there's one for Japan. We will be issuing a new one in the fall of 2015 in a couple of months. Let me then take the opportunity to highlight what I think is really what our findings are and kind of supplement or complement the findings of, we're going to try again? Okay. We're trying to complement some of the findings that Bruce discussed, and I want to say a couple of things why we did this project. The first thing is, of course, this project was launched around 2010, and it was in the context of the President Obama's pivot or rebalance policy to Asia, paying more attention to our interests and our interactions in Asia. And the second context was, of course, the rise of many Asian powers. Oh, it is visible now. Okay. So let me see if I can just go to this for a second. Here's the site. I'll click on Japan and just give you a quick flavor of what you can do on the site. So as you see on the left, interactive data, articles about Japan, graphics, states and districts. So the bottom line is, if you are interested in any of these three areas of the relationship, trade and investment, politics and security, education and exchange, you can go to those sections of the site and read cutting-edge analysis from Japan, from the U.S., from the region. You can also take a look at the graphics. I wanted to show you this interactive graphic data because you might be interested in how this works. I hope this is fairly quick connection here. Okay. So what you can do on this graphic is you can compare any state across the variables or the elements of the relationship. And what are the major elements? We cover trade, foreign direct investment, tourism, air flights, student exchanges, sister city partnerships. So you can compare, my state is Washington State, you can compare it to California. You can compare over years, depending on slides. Eventually, this will be able to compare, to just take one example, Japanese investment in all U.S. states compared to Korean Americans in every U.S. state. So it takes a long time to build that kind of site, but that's the process where this site is going. So I would urge you to go ahead and one thing I did want to just point out to you is if you are interested in your particular locality and its interactions, so we can take California here, show the full list. And here's Japan and California District 13. And you can click on it and get a printable PDF of the relationship between the 13th District and California for trade, composition of exports, Japanese students, travel, tourism, et cetera. So it gives you an idea how this can be used. But what I really want to share with you are the findings. And I'd like to sort of, in my very limited time, share with you five findings. One is that Japan, across all elements of interactions, trade, investment, tourism, students, air flights, et cetera, Japan still remains the number one country in the Asia-Pacific region for the United States across all variables and the distribution of states. In fact, in most categories, it remains roughly between second and fifth across the globe. So to give you one example, Japan is second only to the United Kingdom in terms of foreign direct investment in the United States. And second behind, in front of the Dutch, but Dutch foreign direct investment, it does not employ nearly as many people as Japan. So I'll come back to that because I think the foreign direct investment is a very interesting part, particularly given the nature of changing trade patterns and the way production and supply chains are beginning to work. So the one thing is the continued importance of Japan across all elements of the kinds of social, civic, economic relations. And I'll leave out for the moment the security relations, which are so fundamental and Bruce referred to, which aren't accounted for, obviously, in a project like that. And I can think of no other security relationship of that depth and scale as the U.S.-Japan relationship. The second point I want to make, a big finding, is that this counters a narrative, which is not a false narrative, but a narrative nonetheless, that Japan lost two decades essentially from the early 1990s until the early 2000s in terms of its economy and its society. We've all probably read or heard of the numerous prime ministers and the rotation of prime ministers. We heard about the slowdown of economic growth. We heard that the bubble burst after the appreciation of the Japanese yen in 1985 and the so-called Plaza Accord period. So this notion that Japan was lost, that it's all of this change in the U.S.-Japan relationship occurred in the midst of the last two or two and a half decades. So if you think of the Japanese-U.S. investment relationship, it's essentially about 30 years old, and it's already in second place, whereas the U.K. and the Dutch relationship, of course, knowing our American history, goes back almost 200-plus years. So in 30-year span, Japan has become second, surpassing every European foreign direct investor with a much longer historical relationship of foreign direct investment. The third point I want to make is that not only was Japan, quote, had its lost decades in the 90s and the 2000s. But this is parallel with another narrative, which is the rise of the rest of Asia. Remember that the Republic of Korea became an OECD member over the last decade. India has been seen as rising and is currently, in current statistics, the fastest growing country in the Asia Pacific in terms of GDP, though comparatively small GDP. And of course, the mother of all stories of Asia's rise, which is the rise of China. So even within that context, Japan remains very important. The third or fourth point I want to emphasize is foreign direct investment. And I want to just give you an idea of the scale of Japanese foreign direct investment. First of all, for both the last 2 years, Japanese foreign direct investment has been the top source in both 2013 and 2014, the latest years for which we have data. In 2013, it was, I think, $44.9 billion, $37.7 in the latest year. And I'm only talking about foreign direct investment, an investment that comes into real estate, property, equipment, facilities in the United States. I'm leaving out Japanese holding of government debt. This couple months ago, Japan surpassed China again for the holding of the largest amount of U.S. Treasury bills. And I'm also excluding portfolio investment, which is, of course, very rapidly changing. It's sort of hard to put a precise number at a precise time on it. The second point I want to make is that Japan's cumulative foreign direct investment position in the United States in terms of stock holdings is, as I said, second only to the United Kingdom at $342 billion. And unlike any other country except the UK, with whom we've had a relationship since we revolted against them some 200 plus years ago, it's important to remember that Japanese trade and investment relationships in the United States rank second for the balance between trade and investment, which is a very interesting phenomena given the changes in production and supply networks that are occurring over the last 15 to 20 years as these develop. The fourth important point is that labor, and particularly the character of Americans employed by Japanese foreign direct investment. Japan today employs roughly, we think, please do not use these, you've heard of the jokes about statistics. We think somewhere between 700,000 and a million U.S. employees because of foreign direct investment. That's second to the U.K.'s estimated around 900 million. Another very interesting point that I would mention to you about these narratives of Japan being lost or being wayward is that Japanese corporations who maintained mainland employment during the financial crisis of 2007 onwards. So in other words, they did not shed significantly jobs like many other countries did in terms of their mainland employment. I can go on and on with these statistics, but I think you get a sense. And if you cut these figures or slice and dice these figures other ways, you find that some, I don't want to misquote these numbers, but just to give you an example, for 64% of U.S. states, Japan represents still 5% of their global exports. For 41%, almost 20% of their exports. 22% of states export more than $1.5 billion of goods in Japan. And this in the context of what Bruce was saying about the reduction in deficit. So the point is that Japan, particularly in the area of foreign direct investment, which I believe far more represents contemporary economic relationships than trade, for reasons we can discuss, because many of the of trade now, because of the production and supply chain, tends to be farmed out or intermediate goods, whereas foreign direct investment in the United States tends to have direct employment impacts. The fourth or fifth point I want to emphasize about our findings is that the TPP, or the Trans-Pacific Partnership, as you know, is open and perhaps going to be voted on by the House of Representatives either tomorrow or fairly soon. This study suggests that we have produced a baseline for analyzing what happens to the U.S.-Japan relationship as a result of TPP. All the modeling and studies that we have done at the East-West Center, my colleagues, Dr. Peter Petrie, Dr. Michael Plummer, we think Vietnam and Malaysia are likely to be the largest gainers as a result of the Trans-Pacific Partnership because they are relatively underdeveloped economies which will gain from a high standards agreement. But one of the things we're very keen to check in a year or two is what happens to the U.S.-Japan relationship as a result of TPP if it goes forward. What will be the net impacts on trade, investment, and other ties? And then finally, I would mention to you, I've been focusing on the Japan inward side, but our study is called Japan Matters for America, America Matters for Japan. So in our booklet, we also provide analysis of how U.S. impacts every prefecture in Japan. And as Japanese society and the Japanese economic systems begins to slowly decentralize, and as there begins to be more competition for resources at the prefectural level, we will also be monitoring how American investment, trade, and other flows expand or not into Japanese prefectures. So those are some of the findings of our study. Simply to recapitulate that really what's striking about it, and I have to confess, when we started this, we went with no agenda, no idea of what our precise findings were. I was stunned of how important, really, Japan is for us, not only in terms of other countries in Asia Pacific and the world, but how uniformly important it is to all the major U.S. states and many, many congressional districts. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Sadhu. Appreciate that. And I should have mentioned that both of these projects are available on Sasakawa Peace Foundation USA's website, as well as East-West Center and the Pew Research Center's websites as well. Let's turn now to Ambassador Roos, who's going to give us his views on what this all means and tie it all together. Ambassador Roos?
Well, first of all, let me thank the Commonwealth Club, the East-West Center, Pew Research, the Japan Society of Northern California, and the Sasakawa Peace Foundation for putting this important event together. I found the research to be incredibly informative and interesting. First, let me just start out by saying, and maybe I should apologize, since I was the face of America from 2009 to 2013 in Japan, I certainly hope I did not contribute to the perception of the Japanese that the Americans are not hardworking. I will also tell you that I can confirm, based on my anecdotal evidence with my daughter, who every time we take her out to dinner, including last night for her birthday, and we ask her what she wants to eat, the answer is sushi. So I think that is a little anecdotal evidence to back your findings, Bruce. In any event, most of the findings are not at all surprising to me. The deep trust between the United States and Japan is exactly what I found during my tenure in Japan. And I want to point particularly to the events of March 11, 2011, because that was the biggest crisis to face the Japanese people since World War II. And with this audience here today, oftentimes there is focus on the fact that it was our military operation, Operation Tomodachi, and the rest of the U.S. government that really stepped up in a big way to help the Japanese in their time of crisis. But I also want to acknowledge the people-to-people connections, including the Japan Society of Northern California and the societies throughout this country that really stepped up through not only financial help, but letters from kids, reaching out to the Japanese people. And I will tell you, that had a tremendous impact on the perception of the Japanese of the United States. And to this day, when I go back to Japan, people continue to thank me as the former representative of the American people for what all of you did during that crisis. So a lot of times we look at the strategic relationship, we look at the economic relationship, but let me tell you, it's oftentimes, in my judgment, the people-to-people connections that are by far the most important in connecting our two countries. It also did not surprise me, by the way, that the Japanese pointed to the strategic alliance as being incredibly, incredibly important. The alliance between the United States and Japan really has been primarily responsible for maintaining peace and security in that region of the world for over five decades now. And that region of the world is becoming increasingly more tenuous. with the threat of North Korea and all that's going on with regard to China in the South China Sea and the East China Sea. So I think it is not at all surprising to me that the Japanese look at the alliance between the United States and Japan as becoming increasingly important. Now, one thing to keep a watch on with regard to the increasing depth of the alliance between our two countries is the changes that are taking place in Japan as we speak with Prime Minister Abe's policy of Japan becoming, quote, a more normal nation. And that means that they're moving more towards collective self-defense, possible in the long term, modifying or amending Article 9 of their constitution that allows them to have more of an offensive in addition to a defensive capability. And again, that is a reaction to the threats in the area. One thing that I was surprised at, as Bruce mentioned, the fact that the United States is a little more, our public opinion is a little more tenuous with regard to Japan stepping up in that regard. Because I will tell you, from a U.S. government point of view, we were continually, and continue to do so, encourage Japan to step up and take on more of the responsibilities of the alliance between us. So I think it will be interesting to see how and whether American public opinion evolves as Japan plays more of a role in the strategic alliance. With regard to the importance of the economic relations between Japan and the United States, the findings in these studies were not at all surprising to me. The depth and the breadth of the relationship, but also the acknowledgement in both our countries that China is an incredibly important player and market for both the United States and Japan. So I think what you saw in the findings is a little tension in that regard. The fact that Japan and the United States are very, very important to each other economically, but China is the most important market in the world. And I think that was reflected in the findings. I will tell you that my personal judgment, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is going to be important not only from an economic perspective, and I guess it remains to be seen how important economically it is between Japan and the United States versus other countries in that are part of the TPP. But I believe that it will be very important economically because it will bring down many of the barriers to trade and the agreement has many high standards that will set the tone for economic interaction among the TPP countries. But the point I wanted to make is that it will be important from a strategic element. We've all been talking and reading about President Obama's rebalancing or pivot to Asia. And a lot of times there's discussion or focus on the military rebalance to Asia. But there is a big economic component to that. And TPP will not only bring our countries together economically, but I believe that TPP will be very important strategically for bringing our two countries together. So I would encourage all of you to support that with your local congresspeople. Interestingly, I do see many, many more interactions developing between the United States and Japan. My career has been in Silicon Valley. And the connections between California and Japan, as you saw in the studies, is very deep. But the connections between Silicon Valley and Japan have traditionally not been as deep as they should be. That is beginning to change. And I think you saw that in the fact that Prime Minister Abe, in his recent trip to the United States, made a specific effort to come out here to California and specifically to Silicon Valley to promote that interaction. So I think there is incredible opportunities in that regard. Finally, just let me make a couple of points on the people-to-people connections. The studies talked about Hiroshima and whether or not it was justified, whether or not there is a need for apology. Let me just tell you what my personal experience was in going to Hiroshima. I found that to be one of the most moving experiences during my tenure in Japan. The Japanese people were deeply appreciative that a representative of the United States would go to the commemoration ceremony. The Japanese people, including the survivors of the bombing, were not looking for an apology. What they were looking for was an acknowledgement, and an acknowledgement of history. And it was very interesting. I had been warned when I went to Hiroshima to be very careful in interacting with the survivors of the bombing. And quite frankly, I didn't follow that advice. And as I was leaving the ceremony, I went up to the survivors because they had begun to applaud, and I found that interesting. And when I went up to them and had conversations then and subsequently, it was an acknowledgement that this event had happened and the deep appreciation that the United States had recognized it. And I think some of these types of things are very, very important in acknowledging history and looking forward. And we have examples of that all over the world. Let me just make one final point, because I know we don't have a lot of time, on the people-to-people connections. I believe the biggest risk to the relationship is deep and as broad as that relationship is right now. I believe that the biggest risk is that our younger generations are not sufficiently connected. If you look at the number of Japanese students that are coming to the United States to study, it has dropped like a rock, declined by over 50% in the last decade, and the number of students going to Japan has remained flat. That's the future. That's one of the reasons we started the Tomodachi Initiative, to connect our younger generations. And that's where I believe all of us in this room and in the audience viewing through the internet needs to focus our attention to reverse those numbers, because that is the future of the relationship between our two countries. Thank you, and I look forward to the Q&A.
Thank you, John. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. With 2015 marking the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II, we're discussing the current U.S.-Japan relationship with Japan. Our speakers, John Roos, former U.S. Ambassador to Japan, Satu LeMay, Director of the East-West Center in Washington, Bruce Stokes, Director of Global Economic Attitudes in the Pew Research Center's Global Attitudes Project, and I'm Dan Bob with Sasakawa Peace Foundation USA, a co-host for today's program. You can find video of club programs online on the Commonwealth Club's YouTube channel. Now, I'd like to turn to questions, and we, perhaps not unsurprisingly, have most of the questions that have some relationship to China. Let me begin with a question posed by a member of our audience. Orville Schell, who teaches at Berkeley University, 10 years ago said that the trilateral relationship among the United States, Japan, and China should be and could be win-win-win. I'd like to ask each of our panelists whether that's still possible, if not, why not? Beginning with Ambassador Roos.
Well, I agree with the statement, not only that it should be and could be, but I believe that it must. If you look at the relationship, and we've all talked about the economic relationship between Japan and China, incredibly important, between the United States and China, incredibly important. If you look at trade, investment, debt, where our economies are increasingly intertwined. So I'm getting back to my statement that people-to-people connections are what build relationships between countries. I think we need to focus more and more on those relationships and find areas where the three of us can do things together. Climate change is one great example that we can work together. But it is absolutely critical. The approval ratings between China and Japan are abysmal, and we need to change them. And obviously, even with the United States and China, they are not as strong as they could and should be. So I strongly believe in that statement.
Yes. Well, from my perspective, I also share the belief that the relations between the three have to be managed very carefully. I would note that historically, China has been a central feature of the management of the U.S.-Japan relationship and has gone through various phases of difficulty and easier times. But we are entering a period where all three countries have a very high stake in managing relations well with each other. For those, there are some folks who believe that we can deal with China by strengthening the U.S.-Japan relationship, and there are some others who might counsel that a U.S.-China relationship is key to managing Asia. But given the stakes, economic, people-to-people, security, global issues like climate change, other issues around the world, it's increasingly important that we work trilaterally as well. That's going to be a difficult process, but I think we see signs that even during troughs or depths of the difficulties in the relationship, both Tokyo and Washington, but also to some extent Beijing, have tried very hard to recalibrate and get back on a workable track, if not a warm and easy track. And so I think everything that the U.S. can do to encourage that stability and that progress would be well worth it.
Just a brief comment. Despite the fact that Americans say they need a strong economic relationship with China, they don't like China. Just a little bit over a third of the public have a favorable view of China. And when we ask people what bothers them about China, it's the export of jobs and the trade imbalance. And we know from this survey that publics think China is an unfair trader. So I think to improve U.S.-China relations, the trade situation has to improve. And there's not a whole lot of prospect of that yet. But I do think that it will poison the politics of U.S.-China relations until we see some kind of turnaround there. And on the military side, our survey showed that Americans are aware of the need to help defend their allies in Asia and are willing to do that. So we are willing to stand by Japan, among others. And we understand pragmatically we have to deal with China. Getting public opinion to actually support initiatives vis-a-vis China will be a big, heavy lift.
Can I just make one more quick point? When I was the ambassador and I traveled to China, it was very interesting because I heard from the leaders I met with that why do we have the U.S.-Japan alliance? They viewed it as anti-China and a relic of past history. And I think we have to be very careful because you saw the approval ratings in both our countries of the strategic alliance, and I fundamentally believe in the importance of it in maintaining peace and stability in the region. That being said, we have to be very careful, and I think this administration has been very careful, to continue to send the message that it's not an anti-China alliance.
Thank you. Just sort of along those lines, Bruce, you had mentioned in your comments about the your expectation that the trade relationship with Japan would have been much more negative factor. And I think for those of us old enough to remember 25, 30 years ago, in fact, the view of Japan and its trade practices was sort of where China is today. And when Japan was making some major foreign direct investments, there was vast opposition to that, probably the most emblematic of which was the purchase of the Rockefeller Center. Now, Japanese FDI is second, and you don't hear anything about it. In fact, it's courted by states and localities throughout the country. China has quite a bit of investment potential that they'd like to come here. Some of it has been rejected by the U.S. Is it possible that we might go on the same sort of trajectory with the Chinese, understanding that Japan was and is an ally of ours, treaty ally of ours, and China is not?
Well, I think it is interesting that if you look at the projections of future Chinese investment in the United States, the projection lines have the same slope in the curve of the line as Japanese investment in the past. So the expectation is that we will, 10 years from now, have far more Chinese investment in the United States than we do now, that thousands, if not tens of thousands of Americans will be working for Chinese-owned companies. And I do think that if the experience with Japan is any example, there will be cultural problems. There will be tensions that are created out of that, and we can overcome those over time. We should also bear in mind that Americans who work for Japanese companies are voters. And so their attitudes towards Japan has changed over time because their paycheck now comes from a Japanese company. And I think we can expect that the politics of our relationship with Japan, at least to the China, may in fact change as well over time because more and more Americans work for Chinese companies. Now, that's going to be complicated because Japan was not the strategic challenge that China is. They were an economic challenge, and we were afraid of them. But the relationship with China is much more complex. But I do think we should bear in mind that our politics with China is going to change because of this Chinese investment, and that's unavoidable.
And, of course, there were those who wrote books about the coming war with Japan at the time. But now, Satu, one of the measures that you had in your project is how many Americans work for Japanese companies across all the states and congressional districts, which is, as Bruce mentioned, these are the voters. What do you think about Chinese investment?
Well, I think a couple things. First of all, I think this is a general trend as global capital will move to places where there can be profit and where there are returns for their investors and stockholders and others. And just as a way of pointing out the trend in the Asia-Pacific region, in 2010, Australia, Japan, India, perhaps I have this maybe wrong on ROK, but perhaps ROK, that in that single year, those four Asia-Pacific countries invested more in the United States than we invested in any of those countries. So this is a fundamental trend of development because these countries are developing. It's a very, to me, strikes me as a wonderful thing that countries that were previously poorer are becoming richer. Now, there are a couple of obstacles for future Chinese investment, I think, though I completely agree that the upslope is happening. Governors around the country were just about to release a study of governors' visits to Asia-Pacific capitals and the return on investment and trade as a result of those visits. And it's very interesting to map out where they're beginning to go over time. And they're going to China because it's in their interest to bring back factories that employ their workers. This seems to me make perfect sense, and it's a great thing as long as they're good, well-paying jobs. But in China, which is different from Japan, I think, 30 years ago when Japan really started investing, is Japan was already a developed economy when it started investing and putting FDI in the United States. China will still have, for the next foreseeable future, quite a tremendous capital needs gap within China. So there's a question to me about just how steep that curve will. But I think the overall trend is likely to be that you're going to see more investment from the Republic of Korea, from Taiwan, from India, from other developing. Who knows? In 5-7 years, we may be sitting at this discussion talking about Vietnamese companies invested in the United States and employing American workers.
Great. Well, let me change subjects now to the exchange between at a people-to-people level among students, something, Ambassador Roos, you're very involved in. We have a question from the audience about what accounts for the decrease in undergraduate and graduate students from Japan to the United States and vice versa. And I should mention, first off, of course, the one thing to keep in mind is the demographic issue in Japan. There are far fewer students, so that accounts, I think, for quite some portion of this, and also quite a number of students are going to other English-speaking countries where Australia, New Zealand, where the cost of education is quite a bit smaller. But that certainly doesn't account for all of it. Why the decrease?
Well, you know, when I was living in Japan, one of the things I did was I spent a lot of time going out to universities and to high schools all over Japan, and I asked that question wherever I went. And one of the reasons is demographics, as you pointed out. But there's a whole series of other reasons. Another reason is students are smart. They go where they think their future economic opportunity is. So they view, quite frankly, the United States as not on the rise, and see there are economic opportunity in other areas, including China. There are practical reasons that the students don't come over here, that we're on different academic years. It's hard to transfer credits. Universities here are significantly more expensive than to go to universities in other countries, as well as just stay in Japan. One thing that I continually fought with leaders of corporations is corporate Japan doesn't view it, and this is a generalization, as a positive for students to go overseas and gain that experience. And students feel that if they do that, they will get off track of getting a, quote, lifetime employment job in the major corporations. And then something that never showed up in the polls, but I will tell you, I heard this over and over again, anecdotally, is when the media here portrays violence on the campus and some of the shootings that have taken place, it permeates throughout the world, and parents don't want their children going to a place that they don't perceive as being safe. So there's a whole host of reasons that we need to confront in dealing with this issue.
We should point out that the Japanese government has a goal, the Abe government has a goal of doubling the number of foreigner students studying in Japan and doubling the number of Japanese students studying abroad. Now, whether they can reach that goal is a different issue because of these other problems.
Right.
But the government now finally recognizes this, and they're trying to do something about it.
And we have a goal of doubling the number of students in Japan, though there are no resources for that. Unfortunately, we're down to the last 2 minutes here, but let me just very quickly from each of our panelists ask you about TPP. What is your guess? Will it get through? Will we finalize the negotiations or not? And if not, what are the strategic consequences of that in 15 seconds or less?
Well, actually, the vote that's likely to happen tomorrow is not on TPP, but on the fast-track trade negotiating authority, which would enable Congress to then deal with TPP. The Obama administration claims, but they've claimed this before, that they're very close, and that once this fast-track vote is passed, and if it does pass, that TPP could be finished in a month or so. There's then a prolonged period where Congress gets to look at it and the legislation has to be written. So the real challenge is, will there be a TPP vote this year, this calendar year, in the U.S. Congress? I would say the collective wisdom among trade people in Washington is that the vote on Fast Track tomorrow is really the vote on TPP, and that if Fast Track passes, the assumption is then the TPP will pass. Obviously, the opponents would disagree with that, but I think that's what people assume.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say that I think probably the administration has the 30 or 32 votes that I last looked seemed to be needed in the House, and it will pass but, you know, I can say that because there are no consequences to me personally. but I have to say I can't agree more with Ambassador Roos. This is really critical part of our strategic picture in Asia. And it's very important that we work with our partners who are negotiating parties to the treaty to establish these high standards and rules for trade and investment and economic relationships for the 21st century. So I very much hope that if whatever is needed to push the TPP and the TPA forward is done by the administration and those who look to this long-term gain.
I come from Silicon Valley, where we breed optimism. So, yes, it will pass.
Well, thank you. And I have to say that TPA, as Bruce mentioned, is the vote that's coming up. And my understanding is that Speaker Boehner will not bring this to a vote unless he has counted enough to win. Well, thank you. And thanks to our panelists, Dr. Satou Lemay, Director of East-West Center in Washington, Bruce Stokes, Director of Global Economic Attitudes in the Pew Research Center's Global Attitudes Project, and John Roos, former U.S. Ambassador to Japan. Thanks also to our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet. This program was held in cooperation with the Sasakawa Peace Foundation USA and the Japan Society of Northern California. I'm Dan Bob, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.